Gail Harris and for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. No question, it is a good deal easier to create chaos than to control it. Witness the last few days in Iraq. Moments after the shooting stopped, the looting began. The first targets were the symbols of Saddam Hussein's deposed regime, the beauty and bounty of his fancy palaces, and then his government's ministries and offices. But soon the plunder spread to hospitals, shops, even the Iraq National Museum, a repository of a cultural heritage that stretches back 7,000 years. American troops ordered not to use deadly force to stop the stealing found their combat training ineffectual against a populace determined to take what it could. By Sunday, U.S. troops were guarding banks and hospitals, but many Iraqis are still furious, both at the looters and the troops who had let it happen. Connection listeners, should the U.S. have anticipated the chaos and been better prepared to control it? Or was it wiser to let the looting take its course and then step in? And who should be the peacekeepers now? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We have two guests to guide us through the options in restoring control, and we'll be speaking with them in just a moment. First, though, let's get a sense of what's happening with maintaining security in northern Iraq. I spoke just a few moments ago with Paul Watson, who is correspondent and photographer with the Los Angeles Times. He was in a car about 40 miles north of Tikrit. He said that in the city of Mosul, he saw American troops driving around in two pickup trucks with large American flags on them. I asked how that was going over.
I went into a few different neighborhoods and asked people at a mosque, for instance, and elsewhere, what they thought of it, because they had seen it. They were pretty angry about it. At the time, they said, look, our priority is security. And this is, one person said, these American soldiers are spectators to this looting, that they should be out providing proper security and not doing this. When we saw the U.S. troops today, the flag is still there. On all these individual units, even when it's stationary, they still have a large flag on the back of their vehicle.
So there have been no orders to take those down?
No, definitely not. And I wouldn't even try to guess what the message of that flag is. But, you know, I suppose with a lightly armed force, that it's, to me, it looks much like a puffer fish when, you know, you puff yourself up to make yourself look bigger than you are. They don't have heavy armor and tanks and other things that we see in Baghdad. So a large American flag may make the same sort of impression on people. And in other words, if you give us trouble, there's more behind this.
Tell us a little about the competing forces here. There are Kurdish fighters in the streets, but Mosul is a mostly Arab city.
Well, that's a serious point of friction. I was told yesterday, for instance, that there was actually a shooting of a Kurdish man in front of one of the main hospitals in Mosul, and it's an area of particular concern because of the violence, and we were told by one of the Kurdish commanders it's actually an area where Saddam Hussein's supporters are regrouping and causing trouble. This Kurdish man was shot, and his body was abused in public, and it's the kind of ugly sort of racist killing that people have been warning about, that is, the longer this sort of insecurity goes on, these things become a more permanent part of life, because they've always been under the surface, both because of the way Saddam Hussein ran the country and also because of historic enmities. But with this kind of, not quite anarchy, but certainly unrest, these kinds of things can become a permanent fact of life. So that it's important to very early on get them under control.
Paul, in terms of the looting, as you know, American forces have been told not to use deadly force. Do you see any indications that they are cracking down more than they were, or is the looting slowing down of its own accord?
Well, it's a special situation in Mosul because of the fact that there was not a large U.S. ground force in northern Iraq. And we should remind people the reason for that is that the Turkish government refused to allow ground access for those troops to move into the north. There was supposed to be a very large contingent, the most sophisticated, in fact, armored division in the U.S. Army was supposed to come through the north. When that failed to happen, the only option was to work with the Kurdish guerrilla movements here. So when it came time to provide security in a city like Mosul, there are nowhere near enough American troops to do that, so they have to do it with the two main guerrilla factions. Now, in a mainly Arab city, that rubs a lot of people the wrong way. So there is a semblance of order, but to be quite honest with you, I think most of the looting stopped not because of the U.S. or Kurdish guerrilla forces, but because these civilian neighborhood groups simply took the law into their own hands and took out AK-47s and made darn sure that every car that passed through their neighborhood wasn't full of looted goods.
Commanders elsewhere have said that if they can get the electricity back on, that in and of itself will solve about 75% of the problem. Do you think that's the case in Mosul also?
I wouldn't say. I think what people need more is for some semblance of their ordered lives to come back. It's not just a problem of water and electricity, but they need to know that the police force, you know, people with uniforms and offices where they can go and file a criminal complaint, that all these things that we take for granted in an ordered society are instituted again. So that the problem, for instance, many of the police stations were simply looted and burned. So if somebody wants to go to someone and file a complaint, they don't even know the first person to turn to. So the natural inclination is to take the law into your own hands. If there is some early form of administration, something that has a general consensus behind it, then I think that kind of order will come back to people's lives. They can return to work, they can do the things that they normally do, and not live amid all this chaos.
The sooner the better. Paul, we thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk with us.
Okay, thank you.
Again, that was Paul Watson of the Los Angeles Times reporting from near Tikrit in northern Iraq. You can find his stories and photographs on our website, theconnection.org. And now to my guest this hour. Michelle Flournoy is senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, where she works on defense policy and international security issues. She served in both Clinton administrations as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Strategy and Threat Reduction. Hi, Michelle.
Good morning, Gail.
And Michael Jajich is a retired Air Force colonel and a specialist in peace operations and transnational security threats with firsthand experience on the ground in Kosovo. He is co-editor of Policing the New World Disorder, Peace Operations and Public Security. Hello, Michael.
Pleasure to be here, Gail.
Well, thank you both for joining us. First, let's take the surprise question. I take it that neither of you were very surprised by this. Michelle, why not?
Well, if you look at the various cases over the last 10 years where we've had post-conflict situations, one of the things that consistently happens is there's a security vacuum immediately after the combat concludes. The security institutions, which were often instruments of repression of the government, they fade away into the society. And often these societies, such as in Iraq, are very traumatized, very angry, and part of their jubilation very easily bleeds into looting as a sort of a way of getting back at the government and of taking something back after years and years of oppression and deprivation. So I think those of us who've studied the past cases expected this kind of phenomenon to occur.
And Mike, drawing on your experience and knowledge from Kosovo, from Haiti, and elsewhere, any surprises for you here?
Well, we've seen this movie before, and it started in Panama when we went in and deposed the Noriega regime, and we're surprised to discover that when there was no more police force that there was anarchy in the streets, and U.S. military police had to be brought in. This happened again in Haiti. And after a couple of days, the decision was reversed that, in fact, we did need military police. And it happened again in Bosnia. We finally started to realize that we needed to bring these forces with us when we went into Kosovo. So each of the multinational brigades, there were five, that went into Kosovo carried with them a military police unit in order to deal with the kind of violence and unrest that took place. And even though it was very unfortunate that the Serb population really was victimized, they might not have been able to continue existence in Kosovo if it hadn't been for the presence of those kinds of forces. So the soldiers are going to be responsible for maintaining security and public order until something else can replace them, and they need to have the right capability along with them in order to do that.
Well, if, as you both say, we have been here before, you have to wonder, was this in some measure a deliberate choice to let people take some vengeance against the government targets, and then things just got out of hand? I mean, for example, the looting at the Iraq National Library and Museum, there are now priceless treasures there that are gone perhaps forever. Michelle?
I think that this administration came into office determined not to do nation building. And 9/11 changed that somewhat, in that I think they understood that we had to go into Afghanistan and do something. And even though I don't think we've done enough in Afghanistan, but that's another question. But I think their unwillingness to get the U.S. military involved in nation building, even when our vital interests are at stake, essentially distorted their planning process. They got back into the old pre-1990s line of the U.S. military doesn't do policing. We don't do windows. And that thinking, I think, made them embrace some assumptions that I think were faulty, such as the Iraqi police will stay on the job. The fact is, as Michael said, U.S. forces are the only ones there right now who can do the public security function. And we do have to take immediate steps, as they're doing, to coax Iraqis back into some sort of police force that can act as an interim force. And we have to immediately start long-term redesign and reorganization and retraining of a viable police force. But in the interim, the U.S. military, is really stuck holding the bag on this one. I think where it comes to things like the Antiquities Museum, real national treasures, I think that should have, again, been anticipated, and we should have immediately protected sites like high-value sites like that at a minimum. The other problem I would cite is that we don't have necessarily enough forces to do the public security function universally and comprehensively in the country. Ironically, post-conflict reconstruction and policing often takes more forces than combat. So as other forces flow in, that will certainly be of help.
Well, and also, Mike, you know, with this assumption that perhaps the Iraqi police would stick around, these were not all your regular civil servants. I mean, many of them were very much identified with the Hussein regime, so you have to imagine that they would want to melt away so that they didn't become targets.
Yes, I think you're right. There was a bit of over-optimism there, and I'm making an understatement. There was a lot of thinking about how to vet or to screen the police so that the worst of the worst would not be allowed to remain on the job, but that there would be a substantial number that with whom we were willing to work. And although we'll have to see how many come forward, it seems that they're beginning to vet themselves because they have a guilty conscience and fading away, or else the populace that they've been repressing in the past also could take action against them. So we have an open question: how many of the local police force are going to be available for us to work with? We clearly do need to work with the local population. But I think what we're identifying here is that we're beginning to get a realization of how daunting this task is going to be for us.
It is indeed, and we're going to continue that conversation. Hold your thought there, if you will, Mike. We're talking about peacekeeping this hour, and specifically about maintaining law and order in Iraq. Do you think the U.S. should do this job alone, or turn to the U.N., or leave it to the Iraqis? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection. I'm Gail Harris, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. We're talking this hour about the challenge of peacemaking in Iraq and whether the United States should have had a better plan in place to prevent the widespread looting. Here's what Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld had to say over the weekend.
Stuff happens. But in terms of what's going on in that country, it is a fundamental misunderstanding to see those images over and over and over again of some boy walking out with a vase and say, oh my goodness, you didn't have a plan. That's nonsense.
Connection listeners, do you think it's nonsense? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. And now let me throw a question back to you, Mike. You were talking about some of the challenges of trying to keep the peace as we went to break. I'm wondering how you read the Iraqi anger. Is it directed at the U.S. for failing to anticipate and prevent this chaos, or do you think some of it is also a deep embarrassment that Iraqi civilians are doing this sort of thing?
Well, Gail, I'm no specialist on the Iraqi culture or mentality, but I do have considerable experience in these cases elsewhere. And we've gotten off on the wrong foot. And clearly they're looking to us and evaluating us by whether we're able to provide what they need. And, of course, the first priority is security and public order. And stuff does happen, and it is predictable that this would happen. But I'll tell you one of the other things that's happening based on, or at least what we should be very concerned about, based on what happened in Kosovo. The people we went to liberate ended up being the biggest problem for us. A power struggle erupted between and within the Kosovar Albanian community. About this point in the process, after the 78-day bombing campaign was over, about a week later, four of Ibrahim Rugova's, the pacifist, the moderate Kosovar leader, four of his bodyguards were assassinated, tortured and assassinated by members of the Kosovo Liberation Army. And a power struggle raged under our noses, and we didn't even recognize it. And only now, in the last year, have we come to be able to come to grips with it. 70 or 80 former and some very senior Kosovo Liberation Army commanders have been brought to justice. That's what is going to happen, I think, in the different ethnic communities, that power, there is a power vacuum. And who is going to fill that vacuum, and how are we going to ensure that the people with guns are not the ones who end up on top? That's the challenge that I'm most concerned about. And just to add a final thought, we need help. We need to internationalize and civilianize not only public order, but the entire rule of law, institutionalization of the rule of law in Iraq, if we're going to have a successful outcome to this regime change.
Michelle, I was struck by one report last week that said that in Basra there was a large and angry mob that had gathered in a square, and when asked what they were doing, one man explained cheerfully that they were there to rob the banks. So that certainly suggests a certain feeling of entitlement.
Again, this is the Iraqi population has been deeply traumatized. They feel that so much has been taken from them by Saddam Hussein's regime, and they want something back. And anything that is a symbol of power, they, you know, I think feel entitled to taking something back. I don't want to underestimate how difficult this is. There is no perfect solution. There's no way we could have prevented looting entirely. I think the question is, you know, how do you minimize it where it's truly damaging? How do you minimize it getting out of hand and turning into, bleeding into, you know, revenge killings, for example? I don't want to underestimate the challenge here, but I think there are some steps we could have taken to have channeled this and contained it a little better than we have.
You know, one of the things that we're hearing is that soldiers who are trained for combat really can't be expected to turn around and act as police. And I have to wonder why not, because both jobs involve guns, authority, force. What is the big difference here, Mike? Ahead, Michelle.
The real big difference is rules of engagement. A soldier is taught to see a threat, and if he really feels threatened, then he can use deadly force to deal with that threat. Police are taught a much more graduated, controlled type of set of responses. Now, we've had very good record when we have trained soldiers in those ROE in advance and prepared them and not asked them to go back and forth between combat and policing. But ideally you want people trained as police doing policing. That's very rarely available to you in the earliest days and weeks following the end of a war.
Mike, I'd be interested in hearing from you on this, and particularly to the point about if a soldier has to err on one side or the other, is it better to err on the side of inaction versus excessive force, and particularly when you have a lot of media people around ready to document pretty much anything that happens?
Well, you've just posed the very daunting challenge that our soldiers have, and I want to just underscore a couple points that Michelle made. First of all, I'm not sure that even if all of the lessons had been taken on board, that we would have been able to have effectively present sufficient numbers of military police to handle the situation, which flashed at a moment's notice. So I'm not sure that we could have done anything more to prevent what happened. But I do know that the whole issue of rules of engagement was an afterthought, wasn't even addressed until after the fighting began. So the preparation, as Michelle says, to have our soldiers adequately prepared to deal with a predictable problem, wasn't there. And as you point out, what are the options that a soldier has? And so when would you be authorized to use lethal force? And I don't really think that we want our soldiers shooting looters, because then you have that's a very bad relationship to have with the local population. But there's another element, that is very, very quickly going to present a problem for them, is that what do you do after you detain them? These aren't prisoners of war. These are civilians who are committing crimes. And so they're going to need to have some kind of judicial process to determine whether these people should be held in detention, or are they just going to let them loose to run amok again? So they need to have the rest of the, if you will, the rule of law continuum in place before they can effectively deal with this challenge.
Good point, and I want to get back to that in terms of how you set up that kind of justice system, Mike. But first of all, let's let some of our listeners in on the conversation. We'll go first to Baton Rouge, Louisiana, where Mark is on the line. Hi, Mark.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Well, I think really as alarming as the looting is to some Americans, I think it would have been a lot more alarming in a lot of Arab states if instead of the looting, we would have had mass casualties. You know, people in Saddam City knew where a lot of the weapons were stashed. And whenever the soldiers came in, they could have easily, instead of went to the palaces, instead of going to the buildings, they could have went to these caches of weapons and just started taking out some vengeance. You know, you think of all the abuse they had. Instead of the first thing on their minds wasn't to go out and kill somebody, it was to go out and get something that was taken away from them. And if you look at it like that, it could have, the alarm rate, you would say what's happened in looting, I would grade as from 1 to 10 or 5. But if there had been mass casualties, if there had been a lot of people killing a lot of other people, that would have been a 10. It would have been really alarming among the Arab states, I think. And I think that's what we got to look at. Sure, the looting at the museum was, that was an alarming thing, and the hospitals. But I think this thing could have really gotten out of hand bad. I mean, they knew what some of the weapons were. They could have went to them and got them and just decided, you know, I've had a lot of abuse. I was turned in by this guy. I was turned in by these families. And it could have really, I think, gone from just mass looting to mass casualties. And I think that difference right there, now, where do we go
all right
from here?
Well, I'll tell you what, Mark, let's ask where we go from here. Interesting point, Michelle, about perhaps better to take some of that anger out on buildings than other people.
And in some ways, I think the caller has an important point. On the scale of reactions, looting is better than any kind of vigilantism and revenge killings and so forth. And it's also better than, you know, armed mobs roving the streets looking for anyone who had any connection with the regime. So I take that point. Again, I think it's a matter of it's a very delicate balance to try to say, you know, when is looting letting off steam, and in some ways some sort of in a healthy way, ironically, and when does it go too far and start creating sort of mob mentality that can then lead to revenge killings and so forth, or lead to the loss of national treasures, as in this case. So I think there's a fine line, and it's a matter of trying to keep it under control and directed towards things where the least harm can be done.
Mike, is that where you draw the line as well?
Well, I would just like to accentuate the point that the caller made. It has to do with the attitude of the local people towards the presence of the U.S. forces. And in a, if you want to call this a peace operation now, as we move from the combat phase, the consent of the public is a critical issue. And the British military understand how to do this better than really anyone, based on many years of experience with these challenges. And so they get out amongst the people. And this is a very difficult situation because you still have the remnants of the Fedayeen and others who wish to commit suicidal acts against our troops. But then just today they took off their helmets and they had their red berets on and they're patrolling right among the population. But that's the challenge now, to win the hearts and minds. There was no doubt that we were going to win the war. Fortunately, that occurred with minimal civilian casualties. Now the challenge that's really before us, and it's one that we have to meet with others. We need to be able to work together with the international community that have capabilities that are both that we can't provide, but also the acceptance of the local population. Will be much better if we're working together in certainly these law enforcement and judicial capacities. It's not just U.S. soldiers, certainly, or not just the U.S. performing these functions.
If I could just add to that, I think one of the things you need very early is sort of visible signs of change and success. You need to try to get, whether it's electricity, food, water, but also signs of public order. If people say, well, you know, if they come next week or in 2 weeks, isn't that pretty fast? This is a very critical period where days actually matter. And if we make a few missteps, the attitude of the Iraqi people towards the U.S. forces on the ground could change very, very rapidly. So it's extremely important that they experience positive change in their daily lives, both materially and in the sense of security and restored order.
Let's hear from another caller.
If you don't mind me adding something to that, the U.S. Army has an organization or group of people called Civil Affairs, and they are on the ground ready to begin. They are actually, I'm sure, now performing these functions. So you're going to see that, just precisely what Michelle was talking about, happening more and more. And it's very important that that story get out, because not only the effect on the local population, but certainly around the rest of the world, in the Arab countries in particular.
You're listening to The Connection on NPR. And let's go back to our phone lines now to hear from another caller. Motamika is on the line from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, Motamika.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Just a quick comment on the previous caller. Vigilantism and revenge killings may yet come. I hope not, but these are early days. Secondly, you know, Rumsfeld's comments notwithstanding, all the reports on BBC and elsewhere seems to indicate that citizens are really, really angry about the U.S., standing by and watching anarchy and chaos descend. I agree with your guests that, you know, the international community should be brought in immediately, particularly the UN. But I also thought, and this is my question, that the Geneva Convention mandates that the US and Britain take responsibility for instituting law and order in Iraq. This isn't a matter of choice. This isn't a matter of, you know, wondering whether they should be nation building or doing something else. That is what the Geneva Convention says, and since the U.S. has been screaming Geneva Convention throughout this war, what's happened to it now?
Thanks for the call, Motamika. Michelle, you want to take that one on?
Sure. I think we do have a responsibility, particularly in the case since this is a war that we chose the timing of it, we began it. I think we have a tremendous responsibility to do right by the Iraqi people, to provide for their security until their own institutions can do so. But again, I think we're running up against a very deeply held view inside parts of the U.S. military and certainly in this administration that, you know, the U.S. military doesn't do windows. This is not the appropriate mission. And that may be true from in a grand strategic sense, but in situations like this where you are the only force that can do it, it's imperative that we step in to do it until we can get international forces and Iraqi forces in place to do it, because the costs of not doing so are very, very high.
I'd just like to reinforce that Motamika is absolutely right. It's called the Fourth Geneva Convention, the Law of Occupation. And unfortunately, I think we assumed that the Iraqi police would be available to work with the group, the civilian administrators that are coming in under the retired General Garner to provide the security that we are required to provide. And because there is a void, soldiers are going to have to fill that void. And it would be advantageous if we had groups of military police or foreign police units to be brought to bear on this issue as soon as possible. And if they haven't been planned in the follow-on force, just like in Panama or Haiti, it would be advisable to do so. And I would just note that we have some countries that are in the sympathetic to this effort in the coalition, Romania, Poland, Italy, Spain, who do have considerable numbers of those kinds of forces. And this is the kind of thing that we need to be doing, is reaching out and finding ways to work with other countries that can help us in this situation.
So far, we have largely been talking this hour about how U.S. soldiers may not have gotten it right in terms of crowd control, but there are some cases, one of which happened in Najaf. Michelle, I wonder if you'd tell us that story, where they did act wisely.
It's actually a wonderful story that's a testament to both the exceptional quality of people in the U.S. military and the extraordinary training they receive that gives them great judgment. This was a young lieutenant leading a squad of soldiers that they were coming to talk to one of the local clerics. And unfortunately, the crowd around a religious site assumed their intent was hostile for some reason. They didn't understand that the forces were coming in a friendly manner to talk to this cleric. So the crowd became very, very angry and started making very threatening gestures and movement towards this very small squad of U.S. troops. And this young lieutenant had the foresight and the creativity, really, to defuse the situation by telling all of his soldiers to get down on one knee, turn their rifles upside down so that they were pointed down into the ground, and smile. And this seemed to sort of stop the crowd, and they slowly backed away, and the whole situation was diffused. And it's really it's exactly what you hope from the military in terms of that kind of judgment.
I'd just like to add a footnote here. I don't know whether it was the same cleric or the same mosque, but a few days later, a moderate Iraqi cleric was butchered by a crowd, and this is one of the people who had been working with us, and certainly a moderate force and a force for the future. And so this is the other side of the story, and this is the sort of thing that we need to be attentive to, because if the moderates, especially the clerics and the imams, are murdered by whatever element there is in society that is opposed to our presence there, we're not going to have the people to work with that we need to create a properly functioning Iraqi government.
Connection listeners, we're talking about the challenge of bringing law and order to Iraq. What do you think is the best way forward for the United States? Hand security over to the Iraqis, bring in other countries, or go it alone? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection. I'm Gail Harris in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. We're talking this hour about what it will take to bring not just order, but law and order to Iraq. Connection listeners, how long do you think it will take? And how long should Americans stay on the scene? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests are Michelle Flournoy, a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Strategy in the Clinton administration, now at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, and Michael Jajic. He is a retired Air Force colonel who served with the UN peacekeeping mission in Kosovo. And we have Martha on the line from Holliston, Massachusetts. Hi, Martha.
Hello. I'm calling with appreciation, first of all, for this program, which obviously is very timely and important. My concern is especially about the plundering of the National Museum and Library in Baghdad and the lack of respect for world cultural history as well as the Iraqi people that shows. To me, if protecting oil wells and respect for the shrine at Najaf and protecting the Ministry of Oil were priorities, why not those very important sites? And I understand from NPR, thank you very much, that many experts have worked with the Department of Defense over months to clarify important sites in Iraq. And so I would assume that the Department of Defense did have information about this. And so I am just humiliated, ashamed, and horrified that oversight could have happened. I do not blame troops on the ground one bit. I am very, very disturbed at military planners and for allowing this to happen. That should have been a high priority, and I'm wondering why isn't there some way that this can be, that they can be held accountable without passing it off as bad things happen and, oh, gee, there's unrest there? This was different from the plundering of neighborhoods.
All right, Martha, we take your point, and it's a good question. Mike, if you were advising the Pentagon planners here, I mean, they would probably say, listen, it's very difficult when you're being shot at, but they knew going in that there were these archaeological treasures that needed to be preserved. Why not send troops almost immediately to those, at least to those two sites, the library and the National Museum?
Well, I certainly am sympathetic to what your caller has raised in an extremely articulate manner. I don't have any inside information about what the planning was and the tactical decisions that had to be taken on the ground. But I think this really punctuates the fact that we are now responsible for what happens there and those kinds of actions, which really are inexplicable to me why any people would do that, because it's so totally senseless, unless it was a deliberate action just to try to discredit the U.S. presence, but there are going to be plenty of people willing and probably able to do that. So we are now responsible for what happens, at least in the eyes of the world, and we do not have the capabilities on the ground yet to do that. And as we've been discussing, the plan really is to go in and assess the needs when the needs are now not only apparent but immediate and urgent. So we do need to find a way to work effectively with the other institutions in the international community that can help us, that do have these capabilities, to come in and make the situation work properly.
Well, speaking of working with others, there was a quote we found from former U.N. Secretary General Dag Hammarskjöld, who said that peacekeeping is not a job for soldiers, but only soldiers can do it. And so I'm wondering, if that's the case, then who's soldiers? And how long can we expect it to take for that process to work? Is it something the United States can do alone, or should the United Nations get involved as quickly as possible?
I think, Gail, that it's very important for the long-term success of this effort that it not be viewed as an American project. If it is, no matter how well-intentioned, how well-designed, how well-executed, if this is seen as an American project in Iraq, it will be discredited in the region, and it will not, whatever results we achieve will not be sustained. It's very important that we bring in the international community and a UN blessing, I might add, through another Security Council resolution is my preference, to give it real legitimacy and to also begin now the very hard work of institution building. What will really determine the timeline for our presence and the international presence is how quickly we can reorganize, redesign, redeploy a new Iraqi military and a new Iraqi police force that is respectful of human rights, responsive to civil authorities, and so forth. And my guess is that's a 3 to 5 year project at best. I have never seen it done more quickly than that. And Iraq has a lot of particular challenges that will make this very, very difficult to do.
Martha, thanks again for the call. I want to stay on the UN point and go to Susan, who's calling in from La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hi, Susan.
Hi. I really appreciate this show. It's a very important issue, and I find the conversation very stimulating. What I wanted to talk to you about is I kind of question the ability of a very bureaucratic and slow-to-act UN to respond in violent and very fluid situations. And I would just call to your attention the issue of Srebrenica and the fact that a Netherlander UN force, peacekeeping force, was unable to prevent the slaughter of thousands under their protection. And I question the ability of the UN to quickly respond to violent conflicts. They were unable to get support when the situation clearly was worsening, and it was a terrible situation. I just wondered if your guests would like to respond to that.
Thanks for the call, Susan. I'm sure Mike certainly would have some things to say about that.
Let me separate Susan's point into two parts. First of all, can the United Nations respond to that sort of violence? And let's call that peace enforcement. And I think Srebrenica shows that they cannot. But what we have in Iraq is the United States is providing the muscle, the military force that is going to provide a secure environment eventually. But what's needed in what we're discussing now is how do you not only establish public order, but an institutionalized system of justice and rule of law. And the second part of the time required for the UN to respond, one has to take into account that the UN can't even really begin even thinking very much about these things until they have a mandate. In other words, until the Security Council says, we want you to perform this function. And as an example, in Kosovo, they received the task 2 days before they were supposed to begin functioning. Now, not even the U.S. military would be able to respond in a matter of days to such a requirement. So, and of course, the UN is made up of member states. So this caller is correct that it will take the UN a while. But I had mentioned broadly the international community, and we should be aware that the European Union has taken note of these situations that have arisen in the last decade, and they have created a capability of 5,000 police. 1,400 of them are rapidly deployable, and they come in the form of these foreign police units or military police that we've been talking about. Excuse me. And they also have judicial, prosecutorial, and other legal professionals that could be brought to bear, 50 of whom I'm told could be deployed quickly. But they are not going to deploy until there's a UN mandate. So the UN is very important to legitimize and to bring to bear other international capabilities that are in existence. And I would just add the UN Development Program has also been working to identify Arab-speaking and Arab legal professionals, judges and prosecutors who could be brought in as well. So the international community has many valuable capabilities, but they only can be provided once there's a mandate.
Gail, if I could just jump in here, I think what is underlying this conversation is a real sort of paradox in administration policy. On the one hand, they've been very unenthusiastic about the U.S. military stepping in to provide for public security and so forth. On the other hand, they've been very reluctant to expand the UN role beyond humanitarian assistance and long-term development assistance. You really can't have it both ways. If you want the U.S. military to be doing less policing, you've got to turn to the UN to bless the post-conflict operations so that all of these other international capabilities that Mike mentioned can really be brought to bear to relieve some of the burden on U.S. forces.
You're listening to The Connection on NPR. Let's go back to our phone lines now and take a call from Charles, who's calling in from Louisville, Kentucky. Hi, Charles.
Hi, how are you? Hello?
Yes, go ahead, thanks.
Okay. My point is just along the lines of what I'm hearing the other callers making as well, is that maybe we get the UN involved. That may take some time to get the UN involved, but it seems that the coalition partners, countries like Spain and Italy and some of the other countries that have experience in peacekeeping, would be much more quickly available to be brought online to get the on-the-ground peacekeeping in place right now while they work to get some type of UN resolution in place. And I don't know if that was part of the planning for this, but I haven't seen any evidence of it so far. It appears to be just American combat troops that are trying to keep the peace, as it were, in Iraq. And it's going to take a comprehensive effort on the part of a lot of people, including the Iraqi people.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Charles. Appreciate it.
Sure.
Mike, what about that?
Yeah, that's a very good point. In terms of the immediate expediency, we may have to turn to bilateral relations. But let me just broaden the issue. What's the end state to this war? Really, this is a battle in the broader war that we're fighting against global terrorism. And this is not a war that we're going to win unilaterally, win by invading countries and destroying a regime. We've got to make them work, and we've got to build institutions. The approach we took in Afghanistan was called a light footprint, because we didn't want to do nation building. We didn't want to engage in those kinds of activities. And we're finding, in fact, if you look at the Washington Post today, that light footprint and the avoidance of nation building isn't working, and that the court system is populated by judges who are more friendly to the Taliban than they are to the Karzai regime. That's what happens when you have a light footprint. What we're trying to do, it seems, in the case of Iraq, is to have a light footprint but heavy U.S. fingerprints over who's going to run the country. and the two just don't mix. We're not going to be able to be successful there or in the long-term war against global terrorism unless we create structures of cooperation with the international community. And this is a defining moment. Really, this is a watershed in history. We've, in a sense, discredited the UN's ability to do collective security. But this is a mission, if you will, the peacekeeping and peacebuilding and institution building. The UN, the EU, and other international organizations have been working on for some time, and we're going to need to be able to work with them effectively. Now is a defining moment.
And I would just add that I think in addition to internationalizing this effort, we've got to do a better job of engaging the Iraqi people. I mean, holding a job fair to attract police is great, but we really need a national dialogue process, a structured process starting at the local level and building from there to engage Iraqis about how should we deal with these public security challenges? What kind of institutions do you want to build? What kind of process do you want for making those decisions? Who are the leaders that you want to represent you in an interim government? And we really are still at square one or square zero on that process.
And just in a couple words from each of you, is there likely to be any honeymoon phase here at all? Can we do some things quickly now that might not be possible later?
I think it depends on how quickly, again, we meaningfully improve the daily lives of Iraqi people, not only in the material sense, but having them have some sense of returning to normalcy, shops reopen, maybe even get some schools reopened, that sort of thing. That is going to buy us a lot of goodwill. Absent that, I think the tide could turn against us very quickly.
All right.
Let me just turn your question differently in that...
Just in a couple words, Mike. We're almost out of time, please.
Are we properly structured as a U.S. government to address these kinds of challenges? Because we're going to face them in the future.
All right. Thank you both so much. Michelle Flournoy,
thank you.
Michelle is Senior Advisor for Security Issues at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. Michael Jajic, thank you so much.
Pleasure.
He is a retired Air Force colonel, now with the U.S. Institute of Peace. Earlier, we spoke with Paul Watson, correspondent with the Los Angeles Times. And you can see his most recent photos on our website, theconnection.org. Thanks also to Robert Frazier at the Christian Science Monitor in Washington. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Gail Harrison for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.